Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. A violent escalation in the Syrian conflict is possible, top UN-appointed independent rights experts warned on Wednesday as they published their latest report into the near 11-year war. Head of the Commission of Inquiry on Syria, Paolo Pinheiro, said that another Turkish ground operation remains a threat in the north amid the continued mobilization and fighting between Turkish and Turkish-backed forces and Kurdish-led opponents. The flare-up has seen several deadly incidents in recent weeks, including the August shelling of a crowded market in Al-Bab city. 16 civilians were killed, including 5 children. Commissioner Lynn Welchman noted that Israel, the US and Iran-backed forces had also continued to engage in operations in Syria. The panel, which was appointed by and reports to the Human Rights Council, also noted that Russia still actively supports the Syrian government, particularly using airstrikes that have killed civilians and targeted food and water sources, including a well-known water station serving over 200,000 people, it said in a statement. Last week, fresh airstrikes caused further deaths and injuries in Idlib province, which are currently under investigation, the Commission of Inquiry said. The harsh realities of daily life in the occupied Palestinian territories have been well documented, and the past year has provided no relief, UN economists said on Wednesday. A new report on the situation in Gaza and the West Bank from UN trade and development body UNCTAD found that farming, industry and development all suffered in 2021. Today, for instance, the share of agriculture in the Palestinian economy is 6.5% compared with over 12% in 1994. This is partly owing to the Israeli military operation in April 2021, which targeted and devastated farmland, crops, orchards, greenhouses and irrigation systems, and settler violence against Palestinians that hasn't been as bad since 2005, said UNCTAD's Mutasim El-Agra.
This violence includes destruction of property, physical assaults, intimidation, firing of live ammunition, uprooting and destruction of trees, crop vandalization, and so on.
Mr. El-Agra noted that Israeli settlements continued to expand last year, despite several UN resolutions condemning the practice, including Security Council Resolution 2334 from 2016. By November 2021, there were more than 138 settlements recognized by the Government of Israel and 150 unrecognized outposts, more than one-third of which had been built fully or partially on land acknowledged by Israel to belong to Palestinians, UNCTAD said. The people of Ukraine have shown incredible resilience since the Russian invasion more than 6 months ago, but they urgently need the ongoing support of the international community, the UN's Migration Agency chief has insisted. Antonio Vitorino, Director General of the International Organization for Migration, IOM, was speaking after his meeting with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in Kyiv. To date, many thousands of people have been killed in the conflict and more than 6.9 million have been internally displaced, Mr. Vitorino said, adding that another 7 million have fled across Ukraine's borders. Although international support has focused on the humanitarian emergency, the IOM chief maintained that support was also needed to sustain people's livelihoods and to help communities re-establish themselves. This can be achieved by supporting small and medium-sized enterprises, rehabilitating schools, and repairing institutions that are providing vital support services, Mr. Vitorino said. To date, the UN Migration Agency has helped close to 800,000 Ukrainians with relief items, cash support, and health services. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Unions representing railroad workers have reached a tentative agreement with their employers to avert a potential strike that was set to start just after midnight tonight, threatening to bring passenger and freight rail service across the United States to a halt. The White House announced the agreement in a statement early this morning, calling it a, quote, important win for our economy and the American people, unquote. The deal must still be ratified by union members. The breakthrough came after Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders blocked a bid by Senate Republicans to pass a bill that would have imposed contract terms on the unions.
Right now, if you work in the freight rail industry, one of the most grueling and dangerous jobs in America, you are entitled to a grand total of sick days, part of the contract negotiations. The rail workers are asking for 15 paid sick days. This is not a radical idea.
The Washington Post reports the proposed contract meets one of the workers' key demands, quote, the ability to take days off for medical care without being subject to discipline. We'll get the latest after headlines. In Minnesota, 15,000 nurses are returning to work today after 3 days spent on picket lines in the largest private sector nurses strike in U.S. history. The nurses want pay increases to keep ahead of spiraling inflation. They say dangerously low staffing levels and pandemic burnout have led to low morale that's driving nurses from the profession. Minnesota Nurses Association President Mary Turner joined picketers outside a children's hospital in Minneapolis Wednesday.
This is a fight for our very profession. And if you guys haven't heard the study out at Illinois University, 51% of the nurses potentially will leave the bedside as of next year. 51%. That is a public health crisis. And so we're pushing for a contract that will draw nurses back to the bedside, because we have plenty of nurses, but we have nurses that don't want to work in the conditions that are out there. And I could say this message to every nurse in every state, and they'd understand what I'm talking about.
The Biden administration says it'll transfer $3.5 billion in frozen Afghan funds to a trust fund in Switzerland, which will use the money to help stabilize Afghanistan's economy. This comes just weeks after a federal judge recommended against efforts by victims of the September 11th attacks to seize half of the $7 billion in Afghanistan's foreign reserves frozen by the U.S. Humanitarian aid groups are calling for all the assets seized by the U.S. to be returned to Afghanistan's central bank, saying the money is critical to mitigating against a humanitarian crisis. The UN says some 6 million Afghans are at risk of famine. More than 95% of the population is not getting enough to eat. In Ukraine, more than 100 homes in the city of Kryvyi Rih were damaged by floodwaters after Russian missiles struck a dam Wednesday, causing a river to overflow its banks. Elsewhere, reports of torture are emerging in formerly Russian-occupied areas reclaimed by Ukraine's military this month. One former prisoner told the BBC he was held by Russians for more than 40 days, tortured with electrocution, forced to hear the screams of other prisoners. This comes amidst growing signs of dissent in Russia. More than 30 Russian municipal deputies have signed a petition demanding the resignation of President Vladimir Putin. Meanwhile, some public officials are now calling Russia's invasion a war instead of a special military operation, as the Kremlin demands. On Wednesday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres spoke by phone with Putin. After the call, Guterres said the near-term chances of a peace deal are minimal and that a ceasefire is nowhere in sight. Today, President Putin is meeting with Chinese leader Xi Jinping in Uzbekistan in a summit meant to showcase growing ties between Moscow and Beijing. Back in the United States, a sweeping abortion ban goes into effect in Indiana today, making only extremely narrow exceptions for medical emergencies, rape, and incest. The ban is being challenged in court by the ACLU and several abortion care providers, with hearings set to start September 19th. In Ohio, a judge has temporarily blocked the state's ban on abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy, saying the right to abortion is protected under Ohio's constitution. The decision restores broad abortion access for at least the next 2 weeks in Ohio. Meanwhile, a Louisiana woman who is barred from aborting a non-viable fetus in her home state has received an abortion in New York. Nancy Davis traveled from her hometown of Baton Rouge to a New York City clinic, a nearly 2,500-mile round-trip journey, after learning her fetus had a fatally flawed skull and would be unable to survive. Davis spoke to reporters ahead of her trip.
The doctors told me that my baby would die shortly after birth. They told me that I should terminate the pregnancy because of the state of Louisiana's abortion ban. They could not perform the procedure. Basically, they said I had to carry my baby to bury my baby. I want you to imagine what it's been like to continue this pregnancy for another 6 weeks after this diagnosis. This is not fair to me, and it should not happen to any other woman.
In Chicago, a federal jury has voted to convict R. Kelly on 6 charges of coercing minors into sexual activity and of producing sex tapes involving a minor. R. Kelly is already serving a 30-year prison sentence after a jury in Brooklyn convicted him of racketeering and sex trafficking charges last year. Kelly's conviction in Chicago will add a minimum of 10 years to that sentence. This conviction comes 14 years after Kelly was infamously acquitted on similar charges. A teenage girl who killed her alleged rapist has been sentenced by an Iowa court to 5 years probation in order to pay his family $150,000. Piper Lewis was 15 years old when she stabbed 37-year-old Zachary Brooks to death. Police and officials agree Lewis was forcibly trafficked to men for sex after running away from home, including at knife point. Lewis says one of those men was Brooks, who raped her multiple times in the weeks before his death. Lewis, who is now 17, pled guilty to involuntary manslaughter and willful injury last year, charges punishable by up to 10 years in jail. Iowa does not have so-called safe harbor laws in place that give underage trafficking victims at least some level of criminal immunity. An ex-aide to Andrew Cuomo has sued the former New York governor for sexual harassment. Charlotte Bennett filed the lawsuit Wednesday in a federal court in New York City, alleging Cuomo repeatedly made inappropriate sexual advances, then sought to smear her reputation when she publicly revealed the harassment. Bennett's lawsuit is the second from at least 11 women who say Cuomo unlawfully groped, kissed, or otherwise sexually harassed them. In Sweden, 4 right-wing parties have agreed to form a new coalition government after winning a narrow majority in Sunday's parliamentary elections. The anti-immigrant far-right Sweden Democrats Party won 73 seats with more than 20% of the vote, becoming the second largest party in Sweden's parliament. The party emerged out of Sweden's neo-Nazi movement of the late 80s. Prime Minister Magdalena Andersson announced her resignation after her government's defeat.
The election result also shows us that the Sweden Democrats, with a big margin, is Sweden's second biggest party. And I know that many Swedes are worried. Many have already met hatred and threats, and even more are worried about becoming a target and hesitate to express themselves in public. I see your concern, and I share it.
Meanwhile, in Italy, polls show a coalition led by the far right is poised to win national elections September 25th. That as the leader of the neo-fascist Brothers of Italy party, Giorgia Meloni, positioned to become Italy's first far-right leader since Benito Mussolini. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Nermeen Sheikh. Hi, Nermeen.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Hi, listeners. This is Carl G. from the Abolitionist Hour on Radio Free Kansas. Every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m., we'll talk about prisons since the Fugitive Slave Act to the Attica Uprising to 2018 prison strike. Stay tuned for more information on strikes and rebellions wherever they occur. Only on the Abolitionist Hour on Radio Free Kansas. Every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m. See you there.
Is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk about the growing movement to unite the effort to free Julian Assange, Mamia Abu-Jamal, and the Palestinian people.
We're going to be speaking with Jeff Mackler,
who's a central organizer of this mass rally. It's pulling together the movement. It's a historic step forward. Listen in.
We'll also be joined by Richard Becker to discuss the U.S.'s provocative actions in respect to the China-Taiwan crisis.
They've sent the head of Congress over there. They've sent a battleship over there. It's plenty scary. There could be a war on the agenda with China.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
Our guest today is veteran socialist and organizer Jeff Mackler. He initiated a call for a mass rally on September 17th in Berkeley, California, in support of Mumia Abu-Jamal, Julian Assange, and Palestinians. In 1982, radio journalist and Black Panther member Mumia Abu-Jamal was wrongfully convicted and sentenced to death for murdering police officer Daniel Faulkner on a Philadelphia street. He served 28 and a half years on death row before his sentence was reduced to life in prison. Still in prison, he has served 40 years. An international movement has developed demanding free Mumia. Award-winning Australian journalist and publisher Julian Assange sits in Belmarsh, a maximum security prison in London. In declining mental and physical health, he's been incarcerated for over 1,000 days while he awaits extradition to the Northern District Federal Court in Virginia, where he will be tried and certainly convicted of violating the Espionage Act of 1917. His crime? Embarrassing the United States by publishing true information about U.S. wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and CIA spying on American public. The Gaza Strip imprisons 1 million Palestinians. It's the largest open-air prison in the world. A month ago, the Israeli military killed 49 people, 17 of them children, in military attacks in Gaza. The weapons were made and supplied by America. North of the Gaza Strip in June, in the Israeli military-occupied territory of the West Bank, an Israeli sniper assassinated the beloved veteran Al Jazeera journalist Shireen Abu Akla, who was covering an Israeli army incursion. She had been reporting on the situation of Palestinians in the West Bank for many, many years. American ideology has it that our country is a force for good in the world, that it is a democratic society, that it promotes freedom and democracy abroad, and that at home it is a place where hard work and every effort leads you to success. But the truth is quite different. These myths are increasingly being exposed for what they are by heroic journalists. Recognizing that free journalism is at stake, a diverse group of organizations are sponsoring the September 17th mass rally in Berkeley, California. Mumia will speak via phone. Vincent DiStefano of the Assange Defense Committee will speak. So will Daniel Ellsberg, famous for his release of the Pentagon Papers. Susan Schnall, president of Vets for Peace. Mama Pam of Friends of Mumia's International Family. The great journalist Chris Hedges. Pulitzer Prize-winning author Alice Walker and Jeff Mackler are among the speakers. Jeff Mackler is a founder and leader of the United National Anti-War Coalition, UNAC. He founded the Northern California Climate Mobilization, and he's the National Secretary of Socialist Action and two-time candidate for the U.S. presidency. Welcome back to Law and Disorder, Jeff.
Glad to be with you.
Jeff, why did you conceive of the idea of a mass rally in support of two journalists and the Palestinians? Your endorsers and speakers represent most every social movement in the USA today. What is their connection? And why did you get Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Alice Walker to talk about both the Palestinians and Julian Assange?
Well, in your latter question, Alice Walker is one of the three national coordinators of the National Committee to Free Julian Assange, along with Dan Ellsberg and Noam Chomsky. Second, Alice Walker is a lifelong fighter for everybody's democratic and human rights, not only in the American Civil Rights Movement, but it was almost exactly 40 years ago that Alice signed a full-page item in the New York Times following the Israeli massacre of 2,000 people at the refugee camps in Lebanon at Shabra and Shatila. And the title of that interesting ad was End All Aid to Apartheid Israel. That was 40 years ago, and Alice was pilloried as an anti-Semite. 40 years later, today, when Alice was disinvited to the annual Berkeley Book Festival on the grounds that she was an anti-Semite. And we organized a committee, Stand With Alice Walker, Anti-Zionism is Not Anti-Semitism. So Alice is a long-term fighter for Palestinian rights, for freedom of Mumia, and Julian Assange. But let me make another point about the interconnection. The United States is seeking to persecute Julian Assange for telling the truth about U.S. wars. It's not just an abstract issue of free speech and democratic rights and the right to tell the truth. Assange was literally one of, I don't know, your audience won't believe it, 6 million people with various forms of national security clearance in the United States. He was the one whistleblower, and they wanted to persecute him. The 6 million people, 1.3 million, work out of the Pentagon with national security clearance, exist to advance the interests of U.S. corporate elite forces. And when one single person, or Edward Snowden, reveals the truth about this, the wrath of hell comes down on him. Mumia is not an abstract prisoner. He's representative of the school-to-prison industrial complex in the United States that imprisons the largest number and percentage of its population in jail. We live in what the 25 million people who walk the streets in the Black Lives Matter movement, in a society of systemic racism. And Mumia is a classic example. Imprisoned, he was a journalist for telling the truth about the racist nature and cop killers and police killers in the Philadelphia police system that was indicted for corruption by the Justice Department. He's been persecuted for 40 years. And of course, the Palestinian movement is coming into its own, and the label that the Berkeley Book Festival put on Alice Walker, that she was an anti-Semite because she opposed the exclusionary, racist, apartheid policies of the Israeli state, that idea is now coming into the fore. 4,000 people signed our petition, Stand With Alice Walker, Anti-Zionism is Not Anti-Racism. So the issues are interconnected. We have 20 speakers on September 17th at Berkeley's First Congregational Church, including two Pulitzer Prize winners, Alice Walker and Chris Hedges. We're going to hear from Mumia directly by a phone contact. We're going to hear from Pentagon Papers defendant Daniel Ellsberg, who was persecuted for releasing the truth about U.S. war crimes in the Vietnam War, where the United States slaughtered 4 million Vietnamese. And we have, believe it or not, a young Palestinian representing the Palestine youth movement who's going to talk about the Sabra and Shatila massacre. So we have a fantastic cast of speakers, central leaders, national leaders of the movement to free Julian, to free Mumia, and free Palestine.
Jeff, yes, and further to what you've just been talking about with respect to your September 17th rally, there have been countless rallies in recent years for Mumia Abu-Jamal, for Julian Assange, to free the Palestinian people. But there have been precious few. Not one comes to mind quickly. But what you've done here, I think, is quite unique. You have got well over 60 endorsers. You have all these amazing speakers that you've talked about. Talking about all of these issues together, would you agree with me when I say that I think that represents a wonderful and important step forward to build the kind of united effort on behalf of democratic rights such as we have left in this country, and there are precious few, down the road. Would you agree with that? And was that part of your thinking in putting together these causes?
Jim Lafferty, I couldn't agree more. For a lifetime, I've tried to build broad, united front type mass action movements to challenge the prerogatives of the system we live in, which is racist to the core, denies civil liberties, and conducts endless wars around the world. So the fact that in literally a week or so, as you mentioned, we have 60 different endorsers, including the nation's leading Palestinian groups, civil rights groups, peace and justice centers, anti-racist groups, church organizations, and on and on and on. We have the speaker, Joe Lombardo, who's the national coordinator of United National Anti-War Coalition. In other words, everybody is on board in this united front effort to mobilize. In our hall holds in Berkeley at the First Congregational Church, 600 people. So we are trying to fill it up. And we're also going to use the event to build support a week later for the national tour of Roger Waters, who is touring the country in 28 cities with the message of free Julian Assange and free Palestine and end the wars and end racist system and end LGBT prejudice. He has booked the two largest halls in the Bay Area. In San Francisco, 18,000 people fit into the convention center in San Francisco for two separate rallies. So we're mobilizing people, and it's happening in 28 cities to reach the literally hundreds of thousands of people. Roger Waters was at Madison Square Garden a few days ago with the message of free Julian Assange and all the other messages. We're trying to build a mass united front movement that takes to the streets to say that we are the majority of the people on these critical questions, free speech and racist wars and U.S. interventions, no to support of the apartheid segregationist state of Israel. And when we do that, we hope to change the consciousness of the American people, or we should say expand the consciousness. The American people are pro-union. They're pro-freedom. They're pro-civil liberties and the right to speak. They're against U.S. wars. But they've been told in recent decades that they're a tiny minority. We want to mobilize people across the country and convince them that they are the majority and that they have the right and authority and power to fundamentally challenge the prerogatives of the system we live in.
Jeff, let me ask you about Mumia Abu-Jamal and how his imprisonment for 40 years reflects on the power of the police unions. The Fraternal Order of Police in Philadelphia is extremely powerful, but that's just one police union across the country. Can you talk a bit about that, please?
Well, I've been the director of the mobilization to free Mumia Abu-Jamal for the past almost 40 years. Mumia is a personal friend. I visit him in prison. He's a highly political and totally innocent person. He exposed the Fraternal Order of Police as a leading journalist in Philadelphia 40 years ago at a time when the U.S. Justice Department was investigating the Fraternal Order of Police and sending a number of Philadelphia cops to jail for engagement in drugs and prostitution and all kinds of other crimes. And at the time, the chief of police in Philadelphia, who became the mayor, Frank Rizzo, literally said that he was going to hold Mumia Abu-Jamal responsible for his attacks on the police department. I have written and spoken widely in Mumia's defense. I wish I had the time to do it now. But I tell your audience that he is an innocent man framed up for a murder he didn't commit. He was visiting a street corner in Philadelphia early in the morning, and every event that happened at that moment was manufactured, including witnesses that have recanted their testimony that said they saw Mumia with a gun, and other witnesses who were driven out of town under threats of persecution if they testified in Mumia's behalf. So Mumia is an innocent man, according to Amnesty International, the NAACP, scores of national unions and others that have demanded his freedom and a new trial. If we free Mumia, it won't just be a single innocent individual. It will be a stunning challenge to the entire racist prison industrial privatized system of mass incarceration in the United States. So I'm looking forward to bringing Mumia home, to having rallies for Mumia at the convention centers where we can mobilize thousands of people for everything he has fought for. He's a union man. He refused to be interviewed when unions were journalist unions were on strike, even though it meant an opportunity to open his case to wide audiences. So free Mumia means free all political prisoners. And let me make this special point. We're not only for freeing Mumia and Matula Shakur and Leonard Peltier, whose spokespersons are going to be at our meeting. We're for freeing all political prisoners. And now let me step into a place for a second that very few have. We are for opening up the prisons and freeing them all. In our view, the racist, sexist, anti-immigrant prison industrial complex is a reflection of a sick society that we live in that persecutes the poor, that refuses and denies them increasingly education and job opportunities. I am for opening the prisons, for mass rehabilitation, for jobs for the poor, ending racist systemic racism in the United States. In time, that's the kind of society that we want to build. And indeed, every successful mass social movement, revolution, if I may say the word, started out by freeing its political prisoners. That's what the French did in 1789 when they freed the Bastille. That's what the revolutionaries did when they defeated Tsarist Russia. They opened the prisons and opened their arms to oppressed people and sought to integrate them into a healthy, democratic, humanistic, sharing, loving society. That's our goal long term. But we don't make a giant distinction between the effects of a racist prison system and the freedom of Mumia Abu-Jamal. They're interconnected.
Jeff Mackler, I've known you long enough and had the pleasure of working with you on a number of important causes over the years. So I know you well enough to know that you don't engage in idle gestures, even on behalf of good causes. You've thought this through. You began to discuss this with us a little bit earlier on the show. But why do you believe, and how do you believe, really, that by linking these causes together the way that you have, that this is going to help not only free Mumia and the Palestinians and Julian Assange, it's going to help build that bigger movement. What is it about this kind of coming together in a united way that history tells us is really the only way to deal, and not to deal piecemeal, but to deal with that which unites us and which demonstrates, if you will, I guess, the underlying connectedness between the forms of repression in this country? Talk to us a bit about that.
Well, that's a perfect question, and I have to tell your audience that I was very proud to work with you, Jim Lafferty, 50, if not 60 years ago, when the United States was indiscriminately bombing Vietnam. And at that time, coming out of the McCarthy era, where anyone who demonstrated was called a communist, where anyone who opposed U.S. policy was labeled with the slander, you know, better dead than red. So at that time, we basically limited the anti-war movement, which is in its infancy, to bring the troops home now. No U.S. intervention, self-determination for the Vietnamese. Today, the times are different. Today, we had 25 million people in the streets saying no to systemic racism, Black Lives Matter. Police cannot murder with impunity and continue to do that. There's something fundamentally wrong with a racist society. Today, a majority support unions, while unionization in the country is at an all-time historic low at 6% in the private sector. Today, the United States intervenes with 1,100 military bases in 110 countries in wars of plunder and intervention and colonial intent. These issues are all in the majority consciousness of the American people. Linking them, like we have done in this initial rally, is a prelude to the broader kinds of unity that we need to be effective. We can only be effective if we win, in my view, the hearts and minds of the majority of the American people. And today, those people are beleaguered. Everyone from the LGBTQI community to the Black movement to the Native American movement to the environment to the civil liberty struggles to the wars abroad, every one of these movements is at a relatively dormant stage today. We want to reunite them, reawaken them, bring them back into the streets, mobilize people to once again convince people that they are the majority, that the government doesn't represent them, that the global warming that we see plaguing the earth, setting fire to the planet, slaughtering people like in Pakistan, 1 million people lost their homes and 1/3 of their country is underwater. We want to convince people that the country that is increasing fossil fuels and engaging in more fossil fuel wars around the world cannot continue in this path, cannot continue in systemic racism, in discrimination, in mass deportations. So we think that the issues are connected, and I think we've taken a big step in proving it because we have, in a matter of weeks, united 60 different organizations and speakers representing 20 in this Berkeley rally on September 17th. At the First Congregational Church.
Jeff Mackler, it's a pleasure to have you on Law and Disorder. I'm Michael Smith. I'm with Jim Lafferty. Both of us are attorneys, and we wanted to ask you a particular question about Julian Assange, because to prevent his truth-telling, the USA has done extraordinary illegal things. Could you please talk about some of the extraordinary illegal things that they've done to Julian Assange?
Well, the first thing is when he exercised his right to seek asylum in the Ecuadorian embassy, United States officials paid Spanish security forces to spy on him. That is, to spy on all of his conversations with his lawyer. They even put in spy mechanisms in the bathroom that he was confined to in the Ecuadorian embassy. It's a violation of basic democratic rights to spy on an individual. It's a violation, in our view, of democratic rights to imprison a non-citizen of the United States, to go halfway on the other side of the world to try to imprison a journalist for telling the truth about U.S. wars. And Julian Assange told the truth about the war in Afghanistan to be, by the way, absolutely confirmed when after 20 years of slaughter and 1 million dead, the United States was forced to retreat from Afghanistan and its project of basically establishing a pro-U.S. government, and I might add, in order to extract $3 trillion of lithium from Afghanistan, the world's largest source, that was a defeat. And Julian Assange exposed that. Not only that, but his case exposed the simple idea that the United States discussed assassinating Julian Assange. That's what the national security state does. U.S. wars and interventions in 110 countries, the poor and oppressed nations especially, include drone bombing, special operations, overt wars, attacks on innocent people. And when Julian Assange revealed that in Iraq, where he literally showed U.S. helicopter pilots shooting down innocent journalists from Associated Press and Reuters on camera and released that collateral murder thing, it was a shock to the American system. But Julian is one individual, but he's representative of what happens, what could be exposed every day of the week, because the United States has 6 million people paid to perpetrate the Orwellian national security state, to create the illusion that the United States is a democracy when it intervenes with war, racism, poverty, sanctions everywhere in the world.
I wonder, too, following up on that, what would it mean if this really poster child now for freedom of the press, which is so essential to any supposed democracy, what would the extradition of him, the trial of him in a conservative federal court in Virginia, where he most certainly be found guilty, and where he stands to face 175 years in prison, his health is already bad and so forth, what would that do if that comes to pass? What would that do to investigative journalism in America down the road?
It's an interesting question. It would definitely put a damper on anyone who challenged the national security state. And remember, as I said, Julian and Edward Snowden and Chelsea Manning were three people out of 6 million who told the truth. And that was three too many for the system that camouflages its perpetration of mass destruction around the world. But on the other hand, I think that the fight that we're conducting to free Julian Assange from Belmarsh prison and stop his deportation, where the United States threatens him under the Espionage Act for telling the truth with 175 years in prison, even if he loses that battle and he comes to the United States, I think the movement will continue. They're not going to be able to silence us if Julian remains in prison. We will continue to demand his freedom along with free press, free speech, free journalism. And I think that fight will inspire journalists around the world, even if we lose the immediate question before us in the British courts. We're a long way off from Julian's lifelong imprisonment. And it's the same thing with Mumia.
Would you please tell us about the details of the rally you're organizing on September 17th? Will it be streamed? How can people get involved in supporting Julian and Mumia and Palestinians? And how can people follow and listen to your work?
Well, you can check our website at freeassange.org. That will tell you everything about the speakers, the rallies, and what you can do, who you can write to, petitions you can sign. That's assangedefense.org. You can contact me in California to help build the rally at jmackler@lmi.net. You can come to the rally and bring your friends and help us get out the word on September 17th at Berkeley's First Congregational Church, which is a few blocks away from the UC Berkeley campus on Dana Street between Durant and Channing. You can come to the rally. You can contribute financially online. You can mix it up with some of the best fighters in the country at the rally. Get involved in the fight to free Mumia, free Julian, free Palestine, and that's what the rally is all about.
Is it going to be live stream, Jeff?
We're still working on that. We're working on getting it videoed and then put it on YouTube. I don't know if we're able to do it live stream at this point, but we're trying.
Well, we'll try to assist you in that respect. Jeff Mackler, I want to say thank you. Thank you very much for all your good work over the years.
I want to thank you too, old men. I've been working with you virtually on every issue for a lifetime, and I'm glad that we're still in it together fighting for a better world. I appreciate your work.
Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom, really, and your experience and your fight with and our fight with the wonderful listeners of this program.
I'm honored.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Trips to Taiwan by congressional leaders like Nancy Pelosi, followed by further trips to Taiwan by other members of Congress, has served to push the United States and China ever closer to a catastrophic conflict. Richard Becker, our guest for this topic today, has written, and I quote, "Pelosi's decision raises the specter of an all-out war between the two world powers, and the consequences of her actions remain, well, to be seen," close quote. The Biden administration, which obviously approved of Pelosi's Taiwan visit, added fuel to the fire by deploying an aircraft carrier off the coast of Taiwan along with accompanying warships. Pelosi's argument that the U.S.-Taiwan relationship was based on a shared belief in, quote, self-determination and self-government, democracy and freedom, close quote, is ridiculous. The U.S. and other colonial efforts to dismember Taiwan from the rest of China goes back to at least the 19th century. And at the end of World War II, the U.S. government supported the Nationalist Party of dictator Chiang Kai-shek in the civil war between his party and the ruling Communist Party of China, a war, by the way, that Chiang lost. After Chiang lost that civil war, he retreated to the island of Taiwan, where he ruled as a vicious dictator. Of course, he continued to receive, with massive military and diplomatic support, the full cooperation and help of the United States government. And even after it was forced, the United States, that is, to abandon its absurd policy that Taiwan somehow represented the legitimate government of all of China, the U.S. has maintained its de facto alliance with the regime in Taiwan. And China, which still claims Taiwan is a part of China, has not ruled out eventually bringing Taiwan back under mainland China's governance, including with the use of force, if need be. Well, our guest today to discuss this growing crisis is Richard Becker. Richard Becker is a leader in the Party for Socialism and Liberation. He's also the Western Regional Coordinator of the ANSWER Coalition, the Coalition to End War and End Racism. And Mr. Becker is the author of a number of books, including Storming the Gates, How the Russian Revolution Changed the World, the book Palestine, Israel and the U.S. Empire, and the book The Myth of Democracy and the Rule of the Banks. Richard Becker, a warm welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks very much, Jim and Mike, too.
All right. Richard, I suspect that most Americans are of the belief that China really has no historical or demographic claim to Taiwan, no rational claim that it really is a part and has been for ages a part of, you know, mainland China. Is China correct what it claims Taiwan is now and really has historically been a part of China?
Well, the official position of the U.S. government is that it is part of China, and that was ratified on February 29th, 1972, and we just marked the 50th anniversary of that with some events around the country and in China as well. The Shanghai communique said that, and this was the Nixon administration and Kissinger, you know, of all characters, who said in its wording, everyone on both sides of the strait, meaning the strait between mainland and Taiwan, recognizes that there is one China. Mm-hmm. And in fact, from a historical point of view, the Chinese control of, and Taiwan is part of, or Formosa as it used to be called, as part of China, dates back to 1683. Of course, it ended and its status completely changed in 1895 when a war between the rising imperialist power Japan and China ended with the colonization of Taiwan by China, which would last until after World War II.
Richard, what do you say to people who argue that what might have once been the case for some generations now, Taiwan has operated completely independent of China? It has a democratically elected government, and that there has been no clear evidence that the majority of Taiwanese wish to rejoin China mainland as one nation. Nevertheless, do you believe China's position that Taiwan must ultimately be brought back under mainland China's control is the correct position?
Well, I think we have to look at this in a somewhat different way, and that is that if Taiwan were to become an independent country, which clearly there are those in the ruling circles of Taiwan and perhaps beyond who want it to be, I don't think it would actually become an independent country. I think it would become an outright colony of the United States. The U.S. has been building up its military forces on Taiwan. Taiwan is really the key pivot. If you look at a map, and the U.S. Indo-Pac Command, as they call it now, the pivot to Asia, the culmination of the pivot to Asia, you can see that Taiwan lies between Japan and Okinawa to its north, and then to its south, the Philippines and Borneo, and also Vietnam, which is not necessarily part of this alliance, but the others all are. They're all part of an alliance. The U.S. military commanders call it the First Island Chain, which is a very ominous terminology if you happen to live in any of those countries. But the pivot is Taiwan, and it's clear that the United States government and the Pentagon, they don't really have any concern for what happens to the people. As a matter of fact, their doctrine says that these countries all must arm themselves and be survivable of a war with China, meaning the, you know, they're going to get hit. They'll be the front line of such a war. And so what we really have is an extremely hypocritical policy of pretense of care for the people of Taiwan and the region, but in reality, they are pawns in the military strategy of the U.S. against China.
The U.S. government, as you pointed out, did finally, and I would argue under having little choice, I guess, in the matter, begrudgingly recognize mainland China, not Taiwan, as the official government of the Chinese people and Chinese nation, but still, of course, has long supported Taiwan in an effort to destabilize China and for other purposes. And now it would seem the U.S. has up the ante, the Pelosi and other congressional delegations making it a point to visit Taiwan and declare their support for the Taiwanese, the U.S. military exercises in the waters off China and the like. Why is the United States doing this now? Do they really want to draw China into some sort of military conflict over Taiwan? If not, what do you think is their reason for their recent really provocative acts?
Well, I think that we have to view these visits and even more importantly, the vast arming of Taiwan, military training, billions and billions of dollars in all kinds of weaponry, weaponry that is clearly designed for a war with China. We have to really see that these are provocative actions. They're provocative actions of the highest order. We could just imagine for, you know, the other way around, if there were these kind of military drills and deployment of forces and the leaders of countries that are hostile to the United States right off the coast of the U.S. And by the way, I should mention, when people think of Taiwan, they think of just this one island. But actually, the Taiwan government still controls what used to be called Komoi. And Komoi is about a mile or to a mile and a half off the coast of China. It's right in the harbor of Xiamen, which is a huge city, a coastal city. It now is called Kinmen Province, but it's a province of Taiwan. So the forces, and I think this is almost never discussed in the U.S., is that there was battles in the late 1950s between the PRC, the People's Republic of China, and the Taiwanese forces, Chiang Kai-shek forces, in that area. So this is not something far distant from China. It's right there. It's right in the way that Hong Kong has been in the past as well.
In one posting that I saw from your organization, the Party for Socialism and Liberation, Richard, there was an editorial claiming that the just-announced new trade talks between the U.S. and the island of Taiwan was another example of Washington's growing and ever more dangerous anti-China offensive. Why do you make that claim?
Well, Taiwan, it's a very good question. Taiwan's main trading partner is China. The clear intent, and it was not disguised in any way, was of the new trade agreement is to try to diminish Taiwan's trade relationship, economic relationship with China. In other words, it's another step toward trying to make Taiwan independent, or to go as far down that path as possible, along with the military, the arming and the training and all that. The economic relationship is extremely important, and it's clear that the U.S. government is trying to diminish that economic relationship, and we believe that it's doing that in the interest of trying to pull Taiwan away from China, but as also a part of a larger strategy, and China is seen very clearly to be one of breaking up China in the long run. People will say, well, how could you break up China? China's so huge. China's powerful now. But, you know, the Soviet Union was pretty powerful, too, and a very large country, and it was broken up. And I think that the intention of the U.S. government is to bring China down as part of what its overall overall strategy, which is seeking global domination, and there should be one superpower in the world, and that superpower must be the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that, because it ties in with what I wanted to ask you next. It is about China is about to overtake the United States as economic powerhouse, and unlike the United States, which exploits foreign countries through, you know, U.S.-controlled institutions like the World Bank or the IMF, China offers cooperation and help to these foreign countries in Africa, Latin America, to build infrastructure through its quote-unquote Belt and Road Initiative. You might explain that to us. I wonder, though, so do you think that the growing economic power of China and, as you mentioned earlier, the growing reach of its help and influence on other nations plays any role in why the United States is now ratcheting up its military pressure on China around the Taiwan issue?
Yeah, and that too is an extremely important question. You know, you can see with the Belt and Road Initiative, anyone who studies it, is that it's bringing economic benefits to the countries that are involved in it, which is why so many countries are flocking to the Belt and Road. So many governments and governments of all different political persuasions are. What makes China different is the government is actually tells the corporations and the banks what to do, unlike the United States, where it's the other way around. And they are able to then extend economic aid, which doesn't necessarily bring immediate benefit to the Chinese government or institutions that the Chinese government is directing. That's not true about the United States. The corporations and the banks tell the government what to do, and they're not going to do things that are not profitable. So what they are doing, like in Africa, which is very involved in the Belt and Road Initiative, in Africa, what the United States is doing to offset growing Chinese influence through the Belt and Road mutually beneficial agreements is build up AFRICOM, the U.S. African and either through AFRICOM or just directly from the Pentagon, but they now have U.S. military all over Africa, and I think that's part of the struggle too.
If China should finally decide to utilize force to return Taiwan under the governance of mainland China, do you think the U.S. would do more than just supply Taiwan with more and more military weapons? Or put another way, Richard, how likely is it that such a situation, the United States and China might find themselves at war, or at least in a proxy war?
I think that's a really great danger, that the provocations going to increase. We're talking about 7,000 miles away from the United States, and here you have the U.S. Pacific Fleet and the Indo-Pac naval and air forces doing all these kind of drills and which are obviously aimed at rehearsals for war with China. And together, you know, the U.S. does them in South Korea with the idea of war against North Korea, you know, and that's what the rehearsals are for. So this is a very dangerous game to be played. I mean, it's not really a game, but it's very dangerous. And I think that the possibility that there could be a war is a very real one. If you hear many of the more conservative, even conservative politicians and analysts and so forth, they're talking about this is a very real possibility in the future, and that even that the war going on in Ukraine, the Russia-Ukraine war, where the U.S. is pumping in huge amounts of money, and Blinken's just there yesterday speaking about this, is, you know, we'll do it, we'll continue to the last. Yeah, they mean to the last Ukrainian. They're willing to fight on, and they want to do that to weaken Russia, to weaken a Russia-China alliance. And all of this revolves around the central strategy, which is one of global domination, but then amplified in the 2018, it was submitted in 2017, National Security Strategy, which shifted the main focus of U.S. global strategy from fighting the war on so-called war on terrorism to major party conflict. I don't think it's possible to interpret that any other way than being aimed at Russia and China.
Well, once again, this is Jim Lafferty along with my co-host Michael Smith here on Law and Disorder, interviewing Richard Becker, the West Coast Regional Director of the ANSWER, Stop War and End Racism Coalition, and who has written a number of books and is an expert indeed on the topic we're talking about today, which is, of course, the growing conflict between the United States and China, between Taiwan and China. But I wanted to follow up with a question based on an answer you gave a minute or so ago relating to the Ukraine. It would seem now that when you have the United States giving as much military aid, billions and billions of military aid to the Ukrainians, not only that, but actually working as advisors with the Ukrainian military to tell them what battles to fight, where to fight it, how to fight those battles, that this is a very real that the United States is really using Ukraine to have a war with Russia, if you will. And you make that same point in terms of what might happen if the Taiwan-Chinese situation gets to be where it is. So I wanted you to talk about that, and also, if you would, how that relates to the fact that some months back, when there were negotiations between Ukraine and Russia, and they laid out their respective demands, kind of bottom-line demands, they seemed to be rather close in certain ways. And yet that has all seemed to go to hell in a basket, at least for the moment, and the bloodshed continues apace, worse perhaps in some ways than ever, not to mention the dangers of the nuclear plant and what have you. One would think that somebody has interfered in that effort. Somebody, some outside forces would seem to have interfered in that effort for a peaceful resolution of the matter early on. Does this not relate to this proxy war idea we're talking about?
Well, certainly it does. I don't think there's any question about that. It's really not a Russia-Ukraine war. That's an oversimplification. It's really a Russia at war with Ukraine and NATO. NATO, all different. I mean, I just heard a little snippet of Blinken's speech in Kiev this morning, and he's talking about the great support, military support that not only the United States but its NATO allies are pouring into Ukraine. I mean, Ukraine can't be fighting this war without this tremendous amount of support, and it's all kinds of support, and much that we don't know about. I'm sure that there's been some just mentions of satellite targeting, and so U.S. satellites, military satellites being used, the intelligence information is being provided, training is being provided. The U.S. has pulled together NATO to all participate, although they have a big problem now, and that is that it was manifested in Prague a few days ago. And that was a demonstration in Prague. And the Czech Republic has about 10 million people. 70,000 was the official estimate of people who came out. And it's a very mixed bag, I have to say, of people from the left, people from the right, people who just don't understand why, you know, they have to go without heat this coming winter in the interest of a NATO war. But it was a huge demonstration. And it's likely, or at least very possible, that will spread, and the kind of demonstrations and opposition will manifest itself. But I think it's really good to look back to the lead up to the war. And the war began what Russia called the military special military operation. The war began on February 24th. In the run up to the war, there were repeated statements from top Washington officials that they were certain. I mean, this is the president, National Security Advisor Campbell, and Blinken, the Secretary of State, all of them saying the same thing. We're sure there's going to be a war. We're sure Russia's going to go into Ukraine. Well, how could they be so sure? The reason that they were so sure was that they were telling the government, and this is what we believe, they were telling the government of Ukraine, just hold out, don't worry, we're there for you. In the end, this will be much better for you, which it obviously isn't. They're paying the price, as well as the Russian troops who are dying, the Ukrainian soldiers and civilians who are dying. But the U.S. refused. The reason they knew that there was going to be an intervention, military intervention, was that they were sure they weren't going to negotiate. And we should remember in December, Russia sent a letter. I think there were six major points that its demands, and the answer of the United States was six no's. No, 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 no. And they had already surrounded over the years Russia with NATO military deployment, despite having made assurances 30-some years ago that they wouldn't do such a thing. They, of course, you can trust them, you know, as far as you can throw. But they were really clearly anticipating a war, and they've clearly been happy with the war.
That not only have they been happy with the war, they're preventing the Ukrainian government from entering into peace negotiations.
Because there seems to be a lot of evidence that the United States and other NATO nations did indeed, when it looked like there might be the possibility of peace some months ago, do all it could to undermine that, and apparently with some success.
Yeah, they want the war to continue. I don't think there's any question about that. I mean, what they're doing has nothing to do with seeking a peaceful solution or even a ceasefire. All the actions that the U.S. government is taking are intended to bolster a position that might not be all that popular inside Ukraine. We don't really know, but we can guess that there's a considerable opposition. But if anyone is really understanding what's happening here, is that they're being used as pawns in NATO's game.
Richard Becker, unfortunately, we're coming to an end to our allotted time. I wanted to ask you where our listeners can learn more about the political party to which you belong and about your various political writings and your political work, and how can people get in touch with you?
Well, the best way is to go to liberationnews.org. Liberationnews.org is website updated daily of the Party for Socialism and Liberation. If you want to learn more also about the party, you can go to pslweb.org, pslweb.org. And you can find a great deal of information on those websites about the issues that we're talking about today.
Richard, continuing for the moment before we do have to end on the question of the war in Ukraine, there has been, of course, great concern about the possibility of a nuclear meltdown and the continued fighting around the nuclear plant, the largest one in Europe. Your thoughts on that and where responsibility may lie and what indeed role, if any, the Western powers are playing in that?
Yeah, again, we have, I think, a very distorted view about this issue as a subset of the larger issue of the war that's going on. I don't think there's any dispute. Russia seized the nuclear plant, which is a very large plant, in the early part of the war and have held it since then. And one of the things that I think is very confusing and should be confusing to people is that you keep talking about shelling back and forth, and with the implication that Russia doing the shelling. Well, you have to ask just from a logical point of view, if Russia holds the nuclear plant, why would Russia be shelling the nuclear plant? So who is shelling the nuclear plant? Well, I think it's pretty clearly, maybe not the plant itself, but the area around the plant, the perimeter of it and so forth, that's from the Ukrainian forces. But that doesn't seem to come out very much in the news. It's always disputed as to who's doing it. Anyways, it has to be a worrisome situation to everyone. It's good that some kind of an agreement appears to have been reached to try to keep the plant operating safely and to try to diminish the military action that's going on around it. So I don't know if there's anything else really I can say about that, because, you know, there's a great deal more information that we don't really have access to.
Richard Becker, I can't thank you enough for joining us on Law and Disorder today. Really, I thank you for your work and for your willingness to come and share your thoughts and that work with our audience.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate the opportunity.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.